Welcome to today's reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Some Sounds of Arizona. And let's begin today's reading with a feature entitled Hunter Mentality. Jaguars should have realistic expectations in 2025. And this feature is written by Jean Frenette of the Jacksonville Times-Union. House money. For head coach Liam Cohen, general manager James Gladstone, and executive vice president of football operations Tony Boselli, that is exactly what the Jacksonville Jaguars leadership structure will be playing with in 2025. House money. That might not be how the new regime chooses to view its first season, but the reality is the Jaguars' power brokers may never have another year where realistic expectations for the team should be tempered as much as this first one. If the Jaguars don't win the AFC South or fall short of reaching the NFL postseason, nobody can rightfully look at the 2025 season as a massive disappointment, barring another 4-win, 13-loss season or worse. But consider this. The Jaguars finished 4 wins, 12 losses, 5 wins, 11 losses, 7-9, 2-14, 4-12, 10-6, 3-14, and 9-8 in previous years whenever a new head coach or GM or both entered the picture. Now, Jacksonville won the division and at least one playoff game in two of those seasons in 2017 and 2022, but those were total surprises. Whatever momentum the Jaguars built under first-year coaches Doug Marone and Doug Peterson, with Dave Caldwell and Trent Baalke respectively as GMs, it quickly died and everybody got fired. The cautiously optimistic belief this time is that owner Shad Khan has finally hired the right coach and GM combo in Cohen and Gladstone. But Jaguars fans likely won't know for sure until this 30-something analytics-driven duo gets a minimum 3 years of running an NFL operation. Just look at the only two long-term tenures in Jaguars history. First, with head coach slash GM Tom Coughlin between 1995 and 2002, and then coach successor Jack Del Rio from 2003 through 2011, and GM James Harris from 2003 until 2008. In both instances, they got into a sustainable winning groove during years 2 and 5 before tapering off. As with most first-year regimes, Jaguar fans see the glass now as half full because everybody welcomes change when things go off the rails. That's especially true as Jacksonville comes off an uplifting NFL draft, which began with Gladstone trading up from number 5 to number 2 to acquire transcendent two-way star Travis Hunter, the nation's top receiver and cornerback. It created a rare scenario where the Jaguars generated legitimate national buzz, totally overshadowing the Tennessee Titans landing Miami quarterback Cam Ward with the top pick. Though Cohen has yet to get his players on the field, there is an excitement level about the Jaguars ascending primarily because of two things. One is new leadership, the other being anticipation of healthy quarterback Trevor Lawrence throwing passes to the dynamic receiver tandem of Hunter and Brian Thomas Jr. Nothing wrong with springtime optimism in struggling NFL cities, but it should be accompanied by a dose of reality. From a roster standpoint, Cohen, Gladstone, and Baselli are in the process of a half rebuild. With Lawrence, pass rushers Josh Hines-Allen and Trayvon Walker, cornerback Tyson Campbell and Thomas either locked in with hefty contracts or viewed as long-term solutions at their positions, the Jaguars have a reputable foundation. No need for a total overhaul. What gets lost amid all the intrigue over Kahn's stunning front office overhaul and the Hunter hoopla is the Jaguars have a new coaching staff trying to initiate a culture change. Players must adjust to the Gladstone quote-unquote ecosystem, one of his favorite and overused buzzwords. Yes, NFL turnarounds can happen quickly, but most of them take longer than one season. Even when the Jaguars showed signs of rapid improvement, as in the years 2017 and 2022, they struggled to sustain it. Cohen cannot even bring himself to think about what the Jaguars might do in 2025. Any talent upgrade from free agency and the draft means little right now without knowing how this team will come together or whether they can stay healthy. Yeah, you're always feeling like you're adding levels of competition and depth to the roster, said Cohen. That's exactly what we did. We do feel like we got better and improved. We will not have a clue until we do this thing more than a week here in terms of being on the grass, because we haven't even been able to truly play football yet. The focus is so deeply rooted in the culture, the way that we're going to play our style of play, and teaching those elements, unquote. Coming off of a 4-win, 13-loss season, where the defense too often looked completely lost and an injury-riddled offense put up just 18.8 points per game, the Jaguars should improve simply by maintaining focus in game-deciding moments. Plus, the Jaguars have significantly upgraded Trevor Lawrence's surrounding cast, spicing up the run game with offensive line depth. They also drafted viable running back options in Virginia Tech blur Bashal Tutten and Syracuse's Swiss Army Knife performer LaQuint Allen, who should motivate 2021 first-round pick Travis Etienne to have a bounce-back season, providing that he remains in Jacksonville. But with a new leadership structure and the Jaguars likely flipping over one-third of their roster, a realistic goal for the year 2025 would be doubling their 4-win total. Given NFL history, anything beyond that would be a nice bonus. In the last 30 years, the average victory total for 214 head coaches in their first year, including those previously employed in that capacity for another team, is 6.96 wins. Of the 41 teams in the last decade who won four or fewer games, 14 of those 41 had a winning season the following year. That suggests that it's not out of the question for the Jaguars to capture a third AFC South title after bottoming out the previous season. But there's no reason to raise expectations sky high after Kahn went against his nature with a total house cleaning. Whatever heat that Cohen, Gladstone, and Baselli feel to turn this franchise around, the real pressure starts coming in the year 2026 after they've had time to change the culture and players can get acclimated to how the team brass want things done. In the meantime, be realistic about the 2025 season, and let's see how the Jaguars do playing with house money. And again, that feature is entitled Hunter Mentality. Jacksonville Jaguars should have realistic expectations in 2025, written by Gene Frenette of the Jacksonville, Florida Times-Union. And in another feature from the NFL draft, the headline reads, Sanders turns his focus to the Browns. This feature, written by Chris Easterling of the Akron Beacon, Dateline Berea, Ohio. In a draft full of enigmas and questions, there was none bigger than Cleveland Browns fifth-round pick Shedeur Sanders. There was, of course, the outsized discourse that surrounded the quarterback son of the Pro Football Hall of Famer and Colorado coach Deion Sanders from the very beginning. How much was self-inflicted by Sanders and his camp, and how much was the result of the perceptions of those engaged in the discourse, is irrelevant at this point, although it absolutely added to the reason why Cleveland was able to trade up to get him at pick number 144. Sanders, in a conference call after he was selected by the Browns with the Cleveland area media, seemed to acknowledge learning his own lessons from the pre-draft experience. At least, he acknowledged it in his own way. Quote, "Do I have any regrets? I feel like in life it's always a way that I can improve," unquote, Sanders said. "So it's always in different areas that I'm able to improve, and some things that I could have done at the time and seemed right at the time. I could have went about it in a different way, and that was more during the season and stuff like that. Yeah," unquote. More than that, however, was an actual on-field discussion of the quarterback himself. It's the part of Sanders that likely will end up being the difference between him becoming some level of successful as an NFL quarterback or just another fifth-round pick who ends up cast to the side, albeit one with a very famous surname. There was always the go-tos on either side of the equation, pros or cons, with Sanders' game. Talk about his record-setting accuracy, better than 70% completion rate in college, or low turnover rate, and the arm strength is brought up, while discussions about his pocket presence is always countered by saying how he's not the athlete that a Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen are at the position. The on-field part was what initiated Sanders' fall from where many pre-draft projections and rankings had him. What was misguided about those evaluations? Cleveland Browns general manager Andrew Berry refused to speculate on when asked. Quote, "I can't really speak on what other people think," Berry said. "I can describe how we view him. We saw him as a highly accurate pocket passer. He does a really good job of protecting the ball. He has enough of the physical characteristics, whether it's arm strength or mobility. Like all young players, there are things to improve. I think that probably much has been said about the number of sacks he's taken. Some of that is environment, and some of that is improvement on his end, for sure. But he probably has a little bit more of a, call it retro or classic style of play," unquote. That style may actually work well within the Browns' offense, assuming that Sanders is able to polish the rough edges. The best quarterbacks in Coach Kevin Stefanski's offenses have been the ones who could stand in the pocket and deliver accurate passes, especially off of the play-action game. The Browns addressed the need to improve their running game by taking a pair of running backs before they took Sanders. Ohio State's Quinshon Judkins and Tennessee's Dylan Sampson. The hope that those two can, in some way, become a next-generation version of Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt would certainly help take pressure off of Sanders, assuming he actually is the quarterback. The expectations outside of the building and inside of it are two different things. Sanders himself understands that. Quote, I'm a Sanders, so of course there's going to be expectations regardless of what pick I am, unquote, he said. Sanders comes into the offseason program as one of five quarterbacks now on the Browns roster, although one, Deshaun Watson, is uncertain for much of the season after having a second surgery to fix a re-torn Achilles. Sanders is not even the higher-drafted rookie quarterback on the roster, as the Browns took Oregon's Dillon Gabriel with pick number 94 in the third round. Sanders and Gabriel will be together in Berea, Ohio for rookie minicamp on May the 9th to May the 11th. After that, they will join veterans Joe Flacco and Kenny Pickett, whom Sanders said reached out to him after being drafted, in what Stefanski has insisted will be a, quote, open competition, unquote, for the job. All of that, ultimately, will be the place where Sanders gets to settle any questions that come with him as quarterback. That is all he's focused on at this point. Quote, get there and handle my business, do what I have to do, Sanders said. Whatever role that is, I'm just thankful for the opportunity, so that's all I can ask for. The rest is on me, unquote. And again, that feature is entitled Sanders Turns His Focus to the Cleveland Browns, written by Chris Easterling of the Akron Beacon. And in other NFL news, headline reads, Harbaugh, Chargers are pretty fired up after the draft. This feature written by Tyler Dragon of USA Today. There is little doubt about the identity that Jim Harbaugh wants to instill on the Los Angeles Chargers. The first two first-round selections of Harbaugh's era with the Chargers have been quintessential Harbaugh-type picks. Tackle Joe Alt was selected number 5 overall in the 2024 draft, and the Chargers used the number 22 pick this year to grab running back Omarion Hampton. Harbaugh's football philosophy is to be a physical, run-oriented football team. Fired up to get an outstanding football player who really loves football and can score the ball. I love the production, over 1,600 yards rushing and 38 catches out of the backfield. He gives us a real weapon out there on all three downs, Harbaugh said. He's durable and an outstanding football player, unquote. The Chargers haven't had a running back top 1,000 yards in a season since Melvin Gordon back in 2017, which predates Harbaugh's arrival. When you watch him, he's physical, he's explosive, he's tough, he's got great balance, he's got excellent speed, gets outside, finishes long runs, and breaks off big gains, Chargers general manager Joe Horvath said. When you watch him in the secondary, he just lowers his shoulders and runs through tackles. Like Coach Harbaugh said, he also has value as a pass receiver. Just another player to add to the stable and get after it, unquote. Harbaugh conceded the Chargers did quarterback Justin Herbert a disservice last year after the team's disheartening loss to the Houston Texans in the wildcard playoffs. Herbert averaged a career-low 227 passing yards per game and was sacked a career-high 41 times last year. Los Angeles didn't have a reliable pass-catching option outside of rookie slot receiver Ladd McConkey, and the backfield gained more yards than expected on only 27% of their carries last season, the fourth lowest mark in the NFL, according to Next Gen Stats. The Chargers selected 5 offensive players in their 9-player draft class, including their first-round pick, Hampton, and Second-round selection, Ole Miss wide receiver Trey Harris, a 6'2", 205-pound physical receiver. Trey Harris, the athleticism, also strength, power, and toughness. And a Marion, that is strength, power, speed, and agility, Harbaugh said. We are pretty fired up, unquote. In addition to the draft class, 6'7", 363-pound guard Mike Becton, 6'1", 242-pound running back Najee Harris, 6'4", 218-pound wide receiver Mike Williams, and 6'3", 248-pound tight end Tyler Conklin were key free agent acquisitions. The Chargers' 20th-ranked offense was lethargic a year ago. The team has made a concerted effort to acquire more offensive talent with more physically imposing players, prototypical Harbaugh-type guys. Weapons for Justin, guys that Justin can get the ball to, Harbaugh said. We are very excited about that, unquote. And again, that short feature entitled Harbaugh, Chargers are, quote-unquote, pretty fired up after the draft, written by Tyler Dragon of USA Today. And from NFL news, let's turn now to some Kentucky Derby news. Headline reads, Chunk of Gold's 32-year-old trainer is ultimate anomaly. This feature written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. Dateline, Louisville, Kentucky. If you have stumbled upon the new Netflix documentary series called Race for the Crown, which chronicles the lead-up to last year's Kentucky Derby all the way through the Triple Crown, you would get the sense that horse racing is a sport of private jets, eccentric billionaires, collecting dozens of high-priced two-year-olds, hoping just one will be good enough to get in the starting gate on the first Saturday in May. And that depiction is not exactly wrong. Especially these days, the reality is that oil sheiks, massive racing partnerships, and ultra-wealthy American moguls buy up so much of the top-end horse flesh and send them to such a small handful of high-profile trainers that the odds are stacked almost impossibly against someone like Ethan West. Who is Ethan West? In more ways than one, he is the ultimate Derby anomaly, but also the kind of personality who gives the race its mystique as the greatest 2 minutes in sports. Not only is West a relative unknown who races mostly at Turfway Park outside of Cincinnati and cheaper tracks in Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, he's a mere 32 years old, has only had a trainer's license for 7 years, and is bringing a horse named Chunk of Gold to the Derby that was purchased for $2,500. Here's the best part. He actually has a decent chance to win. It's a lot of hard work, even more luck, West told USA Today Sports after his horse drew the number 19 post position. It's unbelievable. I really don't have any other words to put into it, unquote. One of the great things about the Derby is that even if Chunk of Gold were to take the roses on May the 3rd, he wouldn't be among the top handful of shocking winners in the 151-year history of the race. That bar has been set impossibly high by the likes of Rich Strike coming home at 80-1 3 years ago. Mind That Bird emerging from New Mexico to win at 50-1 in the year 2009, or Canonero II coming out of Venezuela as a laughingstock before blowing past everyone to win by daylight in the year 1971. Coming off a pair of solid second-place finishes in the Louisiana Derby and Risen Star Stakes in New Orleans, the quickly improving chunk of gold wouldn't be a total stunner. But even Cananero II, who was famously sold to his Venezuelan owners as a yearling for $1,200, was not as humbly priced when you consider that that would have cost about $9,000 in inflation-adjusted dollars today. When you consider the whole package, a relatively new trainer who has only won 168 career races at any level going up against multiple Hall of Famers and a $2,500 horse in the same starting gate as Derby favorite Journalism, who was purchased for $825,000, that's where the true magic of the Kentucky Derby resides. Not in a hedge fund guy who dresses for the racetrack like he's headed to Studio 54 and has Ace of Spades bottles in his refrigerator to celebrate a seven-figure thoroughbred purchase, as the Netflix show suggested by focusing on 2008 Derby-winning owner Michael Yavarone. "People love our story," West said. "Young trainer, small owner, we've come a long way," unquote. Even the way West got into horse racing is pretty unusual. Whereas a lot of the successful young trainers like Chad Brown or Brad Cox entered the sport by doing low-level work around prominent barns and learned the craft by working their way up the apprenticeship ladder, West didn't have an obvious path to a training career. Introduced to the game by his grandparents, who owned a couple horses that ran at the Indiana tracks near where he grew up, it was actually his older brother Aaron who first pursued training as they picked up odd jobs around the local track to make some money. Then, after he graduated high school, the brothers leased a training center to Russell Springs, Kentucky, where they started a business that focused on raising and training younger horses. That grew, and one of us had to go back to the racetrack, West said. And that was me. I didn't have a family at the time, so I did the racetrack traveling back and forth. And then, in 2018, I took a license out of my own and started my own stable. It is unorthodox. Most kids have a foot into it, and they have a dad in the business or a mentor they can follow under. We were just kind of winging it, and now we both have our own productive businesses, unquote. While working in Russell Springs, West, of course, had heard about Terry Stevens, arguably the town's most prominent resident and the owner of a steel manufacturing company that ranks among the country's biggest chain-link fence distributors. West knew of Stevens, but did not know him personally. It just so happened, though, that Stevens purchased a half interest in the horse last year from Chris Melton, who also runs a Kentucky-based training center and had originally purchased him at a two-year-old auction for $2,500. Chunk of Gold was originally slated to go to a trainer in Maryland, but Stevens preferred that the horse run in Kentucky. His advisor recommended West based on a prior relationship. After Chunk of Gold impressively won his debut, Stevens, who owned a piece of 2021 Kentucky Derby fourth-place finisher Obesos, bought out the rest of the horse for $100,000. The first time that West met Stevens in person was in February before Chunk of Gold ran second in the Risen Star, putting him in contention for the Derby. "We are so proud of the horse," West said. "He's brought us a long way. It's easy to say, oh, we're going to get this horse to the Kentucky Derby, but now here we are. It's cool. I really don't know how to put it into words," unquote. Now a father of three, whose wife, Paige, is a racetrack photographer, West could see his life change in significant ways over the coming weeks. Regardless of how Chunk of Gold performs on May the 3rd, just having this platform at the Derby will give him the kind of name recognition and credibility that could open doors into a level of horse racing that typically takes longer than 7 years as a trainer to achieve. Whether you're training horses down there or up here, the horse still comes first, he said. It's your responsibility to get them in the spot where they can compete, whether they are a mediocre horse or a notch below or above turf or dirt. That's our job to figure out. That's all the same, but with the media, the publicity, it's a whole new world, unquote. Then there's the most important question, can he win? That's what the connections for all 20 horses have to figure out this week, but West thinks that Chunk of Gold has a case. Though he has won just once in 4 starts, he has taken forward steps in each race and shown the ability to overcome some adversity in each of his 3 second-place finishes. That all portends well for a Derby where it's hard to avoid traffic trouble in a 20-horse field, and Chunk of Gold should be positioned somewhere in the middle of the pack early and give himself a chance coming around the final turn. Is he good enough? Time will tell. But the mere fact that a $2,500 horse and a 32-year-old trainer who's never won a Grade 1 stakes can compete for the sport's most coveted prize shows another side, and arguably a better side, of horse racing that you're not going to see on Netflix. So the 151st run for the Roses at Churchill Downs is set for Saturday, May the 3rd. Fans can watch the Kentucky Derby, which will be broadcast on NBC, Peacock, and USA Network. The post time is 3:57 p.m. Pacific Time. And competitors will race for a $5 million purse, with $3.1 million going to the first-place winner. Jockeys and trainers typically earn a percentage of their thoroughbreds' winnings, which can range dramatically depending on the agreement in place. And again, that feature is entitled Chunk of Gold's 32-Year-Old Trainer is Ultimate Anomaly, written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. And from horse racing news, let's turn now to some baseball news. The next headline reads, Tampa Bay Rays prospect may be the fastest man in baseball. And this feature, written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today, Dateline Phoenix. What if he never hits a home run his entire major league career? What if he never drives in more than 50 runs in a season? But what if Chandler Simpson changes the complete baseball landscape, exploiting his surreal speed and uncanny ability to get on base, allowing us to view and appreciate the game as if we're turning the clock back a quarter century ago? That's my dream, Simpson, age 24, tells USA Today Sports. Quote, I feel like God gave me the gift to motivate and inspire other generations that come after me. I mean, I've heard it my whole life about the little power that I have. But you don't have to hit home runs in this home run era. There's other stuff that I can do well on the field that can make up for it. I want to prove that you can make it to the big leagues, succeed in the big leagues, and that speed plays, unquote. And oh, does Simpson ever know speed? Simpson, called up to the major leagues with the Tampa Bay Rays last week, may be the fastest man in the game. He has stolen 3 bases in 8 games. He's already turned routine ground balls to second base and one hoppers to first base into hits, hitting 400 entering the week. He once scored from second base on a routine sacrifice fly in college. He was timed running to first base in 3.88 seconds by scouts last week. He stole 104 bases last season in 121 attempts at classes AA and AAA, becoming the first player to steal 100 bases in a minor league season since 2012, and only the third to accomplish the feat in the past 20 years. "I love stealing bases," Simpson says. "It gets me real hyped because I know that when I get on, all eyes are on me. Everybody in the stadium, the pitcher, the catcher, the pitching coach, their manager, all of the fans in the stands, my manager, my teammates, they all know I'm going to steal. It's man versus man, me versus you, and I feel that nobody can stop me," unquote. Well, there actually may be one way to keep him from stealing. Quote, "We were sitting around talking about how we could keep him from stealing bases if he gets on," Arizona Diamondbacks veteran reliever Shelby Miller said. "We decided the best way may be to just throw over to first base three times. That way, if you don't get him, it's just a balk and doesn't count as a stolen base," unquote. Says Diamondbacks starter Brandon Pfaadt, who faced him last week, quote, "He's an absolute game changer with his speed. He's like Luis Arias with speed. If Arias could run like this guy, he'd probably hit 550. This guy's going to be pretty fun to watch as long as you're not facing him," unquote. Next stop, to go where no player has gone since Vince Coleman in 1987, stealing 100 bases in the major leagues. "I would love to see it," Kenny Lofton, the six-time All-Star and five-time stolen base champion, tells USA Today Sports. "Finally, speed is starting to get back into the game, thanks to him, and people understanding just how important it is. Speed guys don't get the glory. They've never gotten the glory. Baseball doesn't make it that important. They just keep talking about home runs. Well, if you want to score runs, what better way than speed? Speed kills, but it's never promoted. Hopefully this young man can bring it back and show people just how important it is in the game. It's time for baseball to praise and support guys like him, not just the home run guys all the time," unquote. If baseball wants to only talk about home runs and power, Simpson may never have his name mentioned again the remainder of his career. Simpson went to the plate 1,119 times during his three-year minor league career. He hit exactly one home run. And naturally, that one didn't clear the fence either. It was an inside-the-park homer on June 7, 2024 against the Biloxi Shuckers. Simpson merely slapped the ball past third baseman Brock Wilken, which then got away from left fielder Javier Warren. The ball rolled to the fence, and by the time Simpson sped around the bases and slid into home, he had his first professional homer. It was his first home run since February 25, 2022, when he hit the only homer of his collegiate career, a grand slam against Gardner Webb for Georgia Tech. Well, that didn't actually go over the fence either. Quote, "The right fielder went up to catch it," Simpson said, "and it topped off his glove and went over the fence," unquote. Simpson, who entered high school at 5'5" and 130 pounds and is now 5'11" and 170 pounds, proudly recalls that he did hit one home run during his senior season at St. Pius X Catholic High School in Atlanta, where his mom is the principal. Atlanta center fielder Michael Harris, who grew up playing against Simpson since they were six-year-olds in Little League and played as rivals during their summer travel leagues, remembers being a witness for the historic moment, with Simpson sprinting around the bases so fast that his own teammates had to tell him to slow down. So, considering Simpson's absence of home run power, pretty easy for the guys back home to provide good-natured teasing. How can you tease him? Harris says. He hits 350 wherever he goes. He steals 100 bases. He knows his game. He's not a guy who's going to try to hit homers. He knows that he can get on base and make an impact with his legs, unquote. Says Tampa Bay Rays reliever Eric Orze, who played with Simpson in the minor leagues, quote, "Dude is electric. It's unbelievable what he does. He's a threat just walking onto the field. He walks to the plate, can mishit a ball, and it's a single. He hits the ball hard, and it's a double or triple. And as soon as he's on first base, the pitcher is worrying because he's going to take second base at some point. And once he does, he's not stopping there," unquote. St. Louis Cardinals center fielder Victor Scott, one of Simpson's closest friends who also grew up in Atlanta, says that their speed is nearly identical. They finished in a dead heat in a foot race in 2023, the year that Scott and Simpson each stole 94 bases in the minor leagues. Still, there is a subtle difference. Scott had a career 264 batting average and 344 on-base percentage with 17 homers in his three minor league seasons. Simpson has a career 324 batting average and 389 on-base percentage with a strikeout rate of just 8.8%. "When he got called up and he FaceTimed me," Scott said, "I think I was more excited than when I got called up. He's just an unbelievable person. He was willing to go up against anybody who went against the grain of what his ideology was and his success. Not everybody is blessed with an insane amount of power, hitting the ball with an exit velocity of 110 miles an hour plus, and hitting 450-foot home runs. But guys like Chandler and myself can be trailblazers for the game. There's more than one way to play this game. You can use your speed to bunt, steal bases, and impact games that way," unquote. Besides, as Simpson will attest, creating havoc on the base paths during an inning can be just as alluring, if not a whole lot more, than spending 20 seconds to round the bases after a home run. "Whenever I step to the plate," Simpson says, "I want to try to wreak havoc. They're going to have to worry about putting me on base. They're going to have to worry about me on base, and it's going to be a problem pitching to other people in the lineup. I want to be that guy who is feared by pitchers and fielders as well," unquote. Simpson, who didn't even play the outfield until he was drafted in the second round in 2022, played shortstop and second base his entire life, doesn't want to be known simply as a speedster. Speed can be negated in the big leagues if you can't get on base and can't play defense. He has much bigger aspirations than being the next Terrence Gore or Billy Hamilton. He watches videotape of hitting champions Rod Carew, Tony Gwynn, Ricky Harrison, Wade Boggs, and Arias, and stolen base kings like Vince Coleman, Hamilton, and Lofton. He examines tapes of sprinters, everyone from Olympians Tyson Gay, Usain Bolt, and Michael Johnson, to determine what mechanics he can incorporate into his own game. He even talked to Gwynn's son, Tony Gwynn Jr., seeking advice and what he learned from his father, the 8-time batting champion who died in 2014. Quote, "I've studied Luis Arias, his hitting drills, what he does in the offseason, all of his hitting mechanics to be a better hitter," Simpson says. "I feel like Arias definitely doesn't get the recognition that he deserves, winning 3 batting titles in a row with 3 different teams. Putting the bat on the ball, not striking out, getting on base, and hitting for average. I want to be that guy too," unquote. And if Simpson is that guy, if he becomes a batting champion, steals 100 bases, or becomes a modern-day version of Ty Cobb, who won 5 batting titles and led the league in stolen bases the same season, look out, world, a new brand of baseball may be coming. Quote, "He plays differently than what people are accustomed to seeing in this modern era of baseball," Rays pitcher Pete Fairbank says. "I think in some ways it's a breath of fresh air to see somebody that has tailored their approach to their skill set. I think that any time you see somebody that has that unique of a skill set and then is willing to play within it, that is something that is admirable. If he's successful, you're going to see a lot of people buy into it," unquote. Says Tampa Bay Rays infielder Brandon Lowe, quote, "The Aaron Judges of the world are few and far between. But I think that the Chandler Simpsons will probably be few and far between as well. I mean, I don't know that I've ever seen anybody float the way that he floats," unquote. The only real question is whether he can terrorize the opposition in the big leagues just as he did in the minors. Simpson has no doubt that he will, proving everyone wrong at each level he played. So what's one more step? Quote, "I think all of us have some questions about how his skill set is going to play up here, right?" Rays manager Kevin Catch said. "You can get a lot of infield hits in the minors, but can you do it up here? We're going to find out," unquote. Says Tampa Bay Rays general manager Eric Neander, quote, "The speed is top of the scale, but it's that bat-to-ball skill that is unique. He doesn't chase. He puts the ball in play at an extremely high rate. He controls the strike zone. There's a reason that he hit 355 last year, and it wasn't just because he was fast," unquote. If successful, who knows, Simpson says, maybe the best athletes may start turning to baseball again, and the increase in young black players will finally start to rise after being stalled at 6% on this year's opening day rosters. Quote, "I feel like there were a lot of black players, but then it kind of dropped off," Simpson says. "But now I feel like change is coming. Believe me, I am ready to be part of it," unquote. And again, that feature is entitled "Rays Prospect May Be the Fastest Man in Baseball," written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today. And in other baseball news, the San Diego Padres pulled off the best trade never made this winter. The Padres told every team in baseball that closer Robert Suarez was available with their money crunch, wanting to shed his $10 million salary. Well, they did not get one trade offer. Not one. Suarez has been perfect this season, going 10 for 10 in save opportunities with a 0.75 ERA and a 0.458 WHIP. Also around the base paths, it has finally happened. They have begun work on the Athletics' $1.75 billion Las Vegas ballpark site, grading the 9-acre stadium site. The groundbreaking ceremony is scheduled for June. The stadium is scheduled to open before the 2028 season. In other baseball news, which story evaporated more quickly this season? The Torpedo Bats or the Los Angeles Dodgers ruining baseball with their mammoth payroll? The Dodgers are a 500 team since opening the regular season with 8 wins, no losses. And the Yankees have discovered that it wasn't the Torpedo Bats, but the Milwaukee Brewers pitching that caused their power surge. In other baseball news, the Philadelphia Phillies, among other teams, are keeping a close eye on St. Louis Cardinals closer Ryan Helsley, who will likely be dealt by the trade deadline. Yet the Phillies are adamant that they will not include top prospects Andrew Painter or Aiden Miller in any trade. And scouts have been in awe by Diamondbacks reliever Juan Murillo, who was discarded by the Dodgers and signed as a minor league free agent by the D-backs. Murillo, who was just called up last week, has been lighting up the radar gun at 100 miles an hour and has yet to give up an earned run. And the Milwaukee Brewers would love to have a mulligan and not expose pitcher Shane Smith to the Rule 5 draft. The Chicago White Sox nabbed Smith with the first pick in December, and he is now their ace, going 1-1 with a 2.30 ERA and a 0.95 whip in his first 5 starts. And the Yankees realize that they have no choice but to take Devin Williams temporarily out of the closer's role with his 11.25 ERA this season. But they remain confident that he will soon be back to being an all-star caliber closer. And another baseball item, the Brewers were planning to pounce on free agent first baseman Paul Goldschmidt this winter. If Rhys Hoskins opted out of his contract, believing he'd have a huge bounce-back season, Hoskins elected to stay, and Goldschmidt, after having the worst season of his 15-year contract, signed a 1-year, $12.5 million contract with the Yankees. Goldschmidt has been everything the Yankees hoped for and more, hitting .365 with an .888 OPS. And in other baseball news, no one has been crushed with more injuries to their outfield than the Tampa Bay Rays, who have 4 outfielders on the injured list and only 3 true outfielders on the roster, with Christopher Morel and rookies Chandler Simpson and Cameron Misner. They acquired Travis Jankowski from the White Sox to give them a veteran reinforcement. And the Toronto Blue Jays are still looking for a return on their 5-year, $92 million investment on outfielder Anthony Santander. He is hitting .179 with 2 homers and a .563 OPS. And remember when Kyle Tucker opened this spring by going 0-for-20 with the Chicago Cubs? Neither does anyone else. No one has made more money this first month of the season than Tucker, whose free agent value has skyrocketed from $300 million to perhaps more than $500 million. And scouts are raving about Diamondbacks' prized infield prospect Jordan Lawler, who is lighting it up at AAA Reno, and predict that he could be their everyday second baseman next season while moving injury-prone Ketel Marte to first base. And Atlanta is in no hurry to call up veteran closer Craig Kimbrel, whose fastball has been clocked at only 92 miles an hour in his first 2 outings at AAA. Considering that the Baltimore Orioles assistant general manager Sig Megdal used to be an engineer at NASA, is it any surprise that the Orioles analytics department is working with engineering researchers to create AI technology to modify how pitchers are scouted and developed? We're in the American League East with some very large market teams, Mejdal told the Baltimore Sun, and in order for us to succeed, we have to be very good at everything. To ignore a potential like this would be foolish, unquote. And future Hall of Fame pitcher Justin Verlander, who is 38 victories shy from 300, had gone 6 starts as of press time without a victory, just 1 shy of the longest drought of his career. And in other baseball news, the scariest part of the New York Mets' torrid start for the rest of the National League East is that they are doing this without starting pitchers Sean Manea and Frankie Montas, and they still have the lowest ERA in baseball. And no one outside their clubhouses believes that the A's or the Marlins will be actual contenders in September because of their pitching flaws, but scouts have been quite impressed with their potent offenses and firmly believe that the Athletics will be in the postseason before they depart for Las Vegas in 3 years. And prayers go out to Minnesota Twins legends Tony Oliva, age 86, and Kent Herbick, age 64, recovering from having strokes within days of one another 2 weeks ago. That's all the time that we have for this edition of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.